Right, I just want to start by thanking Mika, who's organised the seminar today. She's also organised a series for the term, which we're all going to be on sociology in space. So we've got various speakers from various universities through the term. I think there's one every week, isn't there?
Yeah.
On different subjects around that theme of sociology in space. So Mika asked me to introduce Stuart Heldon, who's our first speaker on the series. Absolutely delighted to have Stuart here. He's a professor of political geography at Durham, and his work, I suppose, is at the intersection between politics, philosophy, history, and geography. I suppose that would be roughly where you're placing it. And Stuart's done written a series of books in this area that explore various thinkers, including Heidegger, Lefebvre, Foucault. I suppose they're the main figures that are covered by those. So mapping the present, understanding Henri Lefebvre, speaking against number, terror and territory, and so you're diverting from the three-word title as well. And The Birth of Territory is the forthcoming book that's out later this year, which is a significant piece of work that Stuart's produced. And on top of that, he's edited 7 books, again, visiting some of those figures. In addition to the ones we've mentioned, he's also edited books on Kant and Sloterdijk as well in the last couple of years. And Stuart's also the editor of Society in Space, Environment Plan D, Society in Space, in addition to that. And he runs a blog called Progressive Geographies, which is a brilliant blog. And on a recent post, they provide the stats for the year, and that particular blog had had 240,000 views in the calendar year 2012. So I thought that's an example of impact.
Thank you very much for the invitation. It's a pleasure to be here. I actually lived in York for a couple of years, but this is the first time I've ever spoken here, so thank you for inviting me. I've been working on the question of territory for about a decade, and I've been working on it in a variety of different kind of registers. So some very contemporary political issues around the war on terror, around globalisation and the relation to territory, the European Union, and so on. Conceptually, though, I've also tried to suggest that territory is not a straightforward concept, but has a range of elements within it, and its relation to a number of other geographical or spatial or political terms is complicated and needs some work. So I've tried to think about territory in relation to a number of other categories and ideas, and I'll say a little bit more about that in a moment. And then the major project, which has taken me far too long and is now finally finished, this is the forthcoming book called The Birth of Territory, which was to try to look at territory as a question historically and to try to trace the emergence of the concept of territory within Western political thought out of a variety of different ways of organising the relation between space and power or place and politics, for example. The reason that I've been trying to suggest that territory is something that we really need to unpack and think about in more detail is that I was unhappy with the standard ways that territory was understood within geography, within international relations, and I guess within in other disciplines. One of the ways that the territory has standardly been understood is to think about it as if it is an outcome of territoriality. Territoriality is a particular kind of human behaviour related to animal behaviour, a kind of strategy towards controlling spaces or controlling areas, demarcating them, marking them off, excluding others from them, including others within them, and so on. And that because there's a literature on territoriality in relation to the human, particularly Robert Sachs' 1986 book, Human Territoriality, the suggestion is that because there's a literature on territoriality, there is a literature on territory. But for me, I think the two concepts are not the same and the relation between them is not straightforward. So I was unhappy with that as the way into the question of territory. The other argument is that we can understand territory quite straightforwardly as a bounded space. It's a space that is has got some kind of boundary around it, that it's under the control of a group of people, perhaps a state. Or in Anthony Giddens' phrase, that the state is a bordered power container. You can understand territory in that way. But territory, it seems to me, is actually much more complicated than that. I don't think it's simply the idea that you can take an area and put a boundary around it to create a territory. I think that historically it's much more complicated than that. There's a history of territory, it seems to me, just as there's a history of the state. And so I wanted to open up those questions and think about them so conceptually, but also historically. And one of the reasons for that is a suggestion that a French writer, somebody who did, this was originally a PhD supervised by Nicolas Poulantzas, but Paul Allier suggests in a book called The Invention of Territory, which is largely about the French state and the invention of the French territory, But he says that territory always seems to be linked to possible definitions of the state, to give the state a physical basis which seems to render it inevitable and eternal. And it's partly to try and challenge that relation between the state, that inevitability, that eternal sense, that I thought that understanding the question of territory could be interesting. Because if you can recognise the kind of contingency of territorial arrangements, even the history of the concept of territory, we have ordered things in different ways at different times and in different places. This maybe challenges the way that people think about state in those kinds of ways. And even though, and you probably all know this definition in the sociology department, but Weber's famous definition of the state includes an element of territory within its definition, that the state is that human community within a certain area or territory. And he says, stresses, that this belongs to the feature of the state. This is the central thing of the element of the state. That within that area, the state lays claim to a successful monopoly of legitimate physical violence. But it seems to me that while there's an extensive literature on three of the elements within that definition, human community, legitimacy, violence, the question of territory has almost been assumed as if it's a straightforward element. But for me, it's actually one of the more complicated elements in that definition. And so that was the thing I was interested in opening up much more in many more different ways and to try and examine that kind of question. So this took me to what I wanted to do is to sketch out what I'm calling a conceptual history of territory, or you might call it a genealogy of territory, and we can maybe talk about the kind of methodological questions in discussion if you want. But it was motivated by two kind of questions that I got by looking at other work that I thought opened up these kinds of questions or ideas. One of them was being inspired by the philosopher Edward Casey's work on place and thinking about territory as like place having a complicated history that needed to be examined in a variety of ways. And Casey describes the fate of place actually in one of his later books, but he's looking back at the fate of place, and he discusses it and describes it as a book that traces out the idea of place vis-a-vis space. So one of the questions for me was, what understanding of space was necessary for a notion of territory to be possible? And if we understand that the idea of space has a history, Henri Lefebvre's The Production of Space would be one of the examples of tracing that way that space can be understood in a variety of ways, but that there's not a straightforward relation between those and these have a complicated history. Maybe we could do the same kind of thing for the question of territory. How does territory sit in relation to the history of the concept of space? And the second one was inspired by a geographer, John Gopman, who wrote, I think, one of the best books on the question of territory, a book called The Significance of Territory that came out in the early 1970s. But also in this book on the politics of states and their geography, he says, one cannot conceive a state, a political institution, without its spatial definition, its territory. So how does the state relate to space? How does the state relate to the question of territory? So those, for me, were two of the key questions I was interested in working these through. Now, in trying to think these ideas through, I was trying to work out, well, what have geographers done, not maybe explicitly in thinking about the question of territory, but maybe implicitly? How have they understood these questions without necessarily unpacking them in detail? And one of them is, I think, that territory is often reduced to something that's effectively a kind of a political economic definition, that territory is equated to the notion of land, perhaps land at a grander scale, but it maybe is simply seen in a sort of political economic relation. Property, exclusion, owning, exchange, putting the monetary value to it, and so on. But that seems to me to be, while certainly a central element to the idea, it doesn't seem to me to be sufficient to understand the complexity of the idea of territory. So political economy is important, but not sufficient for these questions. But I was also unhappy with the way that people tried to go beyond a narrowly political economic way of thinking and broaden it into a more sort of strategic register. So some of the work of Michel Foucault, the way that Foucault is being picked up, of the strategic rather than simply the economic being important. And a way that I thought was useful to understand this is the idea of terrain. And terrain is a term that's shared by two main branches of geography, military geography, but also elements of physical geography. And thinking about the question of terrain as something that has particular kinds of qualities that make impact on, say, military manoeuvres or in terms of physical geographers trying to understand the terrain. There's a whole set of questions there that I think are important to understanding the question of territory. But again, like economy, important, but it didn't seem to me to be sufficient to get to grips with the question of territory. So territory for me then was something that many of the existing ways of working didn't actually allow us access towards. The territoriality seemed to me to be important, but not particularly helpful in understanding the historical specificity of territory. land and terrain, the kind of political, economic and political strategic registers, didn't seem to me to be able to get to grips with some of the political complexities of the idea. So I tried to make the claim that territory should be understood beyond simply those political, economic and political strategic ideas of land and terrain. And the first one of them was to take the question of the law much more seriously in understanding this question, and to try to think about how different types of political legal questions, power and authority, notions of sovereignty, supremacy, superiority, jurisdiction and so on, how do these relate to the area to which they apply? Where does the law apply? Where does the law cease to apply? How do we work through questions in the conflict of laws? If a dispute happens between two people from different places, in the third place, which law applies to that dispute and the resolution of that dispute? And a particular question that became important to me historically was, when does territorium become the object of political rule? And there's a whole set of debates in the 13th and 14th century about the relation between territorium and jurisdiction. And that seems to me to be a key element within the story of the emergence of territory as a specifically political object, rather than simply the property of a landowner or a ruler. The second element, and this particularly taken from some of the work of Foucault, Martin Heidegger and others, thinking about the technological, the technical, and what sorts of things get made possible by a transformation in the scientific revolution. So thinking about particular kinds of techniques based on a transformation in mathematics, in areas in geometry, the application of geometry in terms of large-scale land surveying and cartography, thinking about a whole range of other kinds of techniques based on calculation in population statistics, in terms of the census, in terms of the survey of land for its crop yields and so on. These kind of elements seem to me to be crucial in thinking about that kind of question of territory and the command of these large spaces by centralised political authorities. So the argument, and this is borrowing a phrase from Foucault's work on population, but to think of territory as a political technology or as a bundle of political technologies, that it's not simply land and terrain in itself, but it's to do with the techniques that are used and conducted on them to transform them, to utilise them, to make use of them for political authority. So it's to try to say that, yes, territory is certainly a political question, but it's political only if we think of it in a range of registers. And the four that I concentrated on with the economic, the strategic, the legal, and the technical, that those different elements make up the way to think about these questions. So this has been played out in two books, the very contemporary book on the War on Terror and trying to think about these, particularly in terms of transformations in the legal international law around territory, but also in terms of the forthcoming book, the historical book, to try to trace the emergence of that concept of territory within Western political thought. And I apologise for the size of the font on this one, just to give you a sense of the breadth of the historical book, the one that's coming out later this year. It begins with ancient Greek myth and tragedy, goes through Rome and the emergence of the Roman Empire. The big surprise for me, and this is why writing books is interesting, is that you change your mind as you're writing them, because you find out an answer to a question that you didn't know the answer at the beginning, that the Middle Ages became so important to this story. I had an initial sense that I would do at least something with the Middle Ages, but I thought that really it was going to be in early modern Europe that these key transformations were taking place. The Middle Ages ended up being over half of the book. It became a really dominant part of the story that I'm trying to say where different elements that make up the modern notion of territory have come from. Now, I'm certainly happy to talk about that in more detail in discussion, but this is to sort of give a background conceptually and historically about why I ended up working on the question of Shakespeare. Because what I've been trying to suggest in all of this work I've done, politically, historically, conceptually, and so on, is I'm not trying to come up with a better definition of territory, better than the other definitions that could be there in introductory lectures or textbooks of, okay, you know, here's a better definition compared to the other ones. Rather, what I'm trying to do is say, these are the registers within which we need to ask the questions in order to understand how territory has been understood and practiced in different times and in different places. And to suggest that those political, the economic, the strategic, the legal, the technical, are the kinds of questions that we need to ask to understand these relations. So it's to understand it in historical and geographical specificities rather than a fixed kind of ahistorical, ageographical kind of argument. And this took me a lot longer than I thought. The book is 201,000 words. It's a big book. It took me far longer than I wanted. And I really thought, as I ended this, that I was done with the question of territory. I had some other things I wanted to work on, and I really thought that was the end of the project. But towards the end of the eighth chapter, there's a short section on King Lear, which got far too big for the place that I had in mind in that section, and that working on King Lear led me into some questions on Coriolanus, and that led into some questions around Richard II, and I began to realise that maybe there was something else in here. There was another project around the question of Shakespeare and territory. And the idea is that Shakespeare's plays, different plays of Shakespeare, can open up some of the different aspects of the question of territory, perhaps in a different way to what I've done in this historical book, and that would maybe reach a very different audience to the people that might read this historical one. Now, if we look in Shakespeare's plays, the entire canon of Shakespeare's plays, and we're looking simply for the word, we find very few examples in those plays. The word territory only appears in two plays, in King Lear and As You Like It, and the plural territories appears in a few more instances, although one of those is likely a scene that wasn't actually written by Shakespeare, even though elements of the rest of that text were. And yet, it doesn't seem to me that the idea of territory is marginal to Shakespeare's work. I think a number of these plays are structured around ideas of exile, of banishment, of land politics, of spatial division, of contestation, of conquest, of succession. And so it seemed to me that there might be something interesting to do with looking at a range of Shakespeare's plays to open up some of these questions and think about some of these ideas. And this is partly because of the time that Shakespeare's writing, late 16th, early 17th century. It's a time when the modern notion of sovereign territory is really starting to coalesce. It's being articulated in political writings, it's being argued for by political actors in relation to each other, in relation to other authorities such as the Pope within Europe. Shakespeare, I think, then can help us to understand some of the varying aspects to territory, the alternatives to territory, the tensions, the ambiguities, and the limits around the question of territory. That if in Shakespeare's England at his time, late Elizabethan, early Jacobean period, there's a consolidation of political power and political space, a kind of an absolutism, in the Europe that he's writing and relating to in a number of his plays, these political spaces are not consolidated. There's a whole range of contests that are going on in those areas. And Shakespeare's history plays, of course, are relating back to an earlier period of English or British history and the contestations between them, the War of the Roses and other plays and so on. Now, many of those he's using to shed light on what's actually happening at his own time, but it's a less politically dangerous way of thinking about those kinds of aspects. Variety of Shakespeare's plays, then, it seems to me, open up questions around territory that are interesting to explore. And what I've been doing while I've been talking about this project in a variety of settings is to give what I've given you up to now as a general introduction, and then I've focused on different plays or different elements within Shakespeare's plays for the remainder of the talk. I don't have time, of course, to talk about the whole project, but what I want to talk about is the colonial chapter of what's becoming, I think, a draft manuscript on this question. And I want to talk about three plays in particular. The Tempest, which is the obvious play, in a sense, to talk about if you're looking at the colonial in relation to Shakespeare. And I think it is important. I think it does say some interesting things about that. But I also want to, as time allows, to say a little about Pericles and Antony and Cleopatra, which I think also open up some interesting questions there. So The Tempest is, I think, a very interesting play for a variety of reasons. The question of inside and outside, possession and dispossession of land or territory are crucial to the narrative. And there's four key figures in the action in that play that have that kind of relation between possession or dispossession of territory. Prospero and Caliban, obviously, but also Antonio, the usurper, the person who has dispossessed Prospero of his kingdom back in Milan, and Gonzalo, the political advisor. So Prospero, the main character, is the rightful Duke of Milan, but he's been dispossessed of those lands. He's been banished, he's been expelled from Milan, but he has arrived on the island of the Tempest of the play, and he has removed it from Caliban, the person who was living in that island before he, Prospero, had arrived. Now, of his own dispossession, of being expelled from Milan, of having that dukedom taken away from him, he says the following. To have no screen between this part he played and him he played it for, he needs with be absolute Milan. Me, poor man, my library was dukedom large enough. Of temporal royalties he thinks me now incapable. Confederates, so dry he was for sway, with the king of Naples to give him annual tribute, do him homage, subject his coronet to his crown, and bend the dukedom yet unbowed, alas, poor Milan, his most ignoble stooping. What's actually going on in this is a range of things, I think, that are interesting here. Antonio is being suggested wants no distinction between his own role and the position he aspired to, previously occupied by Prospero. Antonio needed to be absolute ruler of Milan. And Prospero suggests that he, the poor man as he describes it, had otherworldly concerns. We hear later how he was bought off by Antonio by the suggestion, knowing I loved my books, he furnished me with mine own library with volumes that I prize above my dukedom. So he's constructing himself as this kind of unworldly person who prized his library more than the possession of the particular place. The temporal royalties that are being talked about here are secular political powers. They're opposed to spiritual powers, the kind of power that the Pope would have, for example, within Europe. Incapable means not simply that he's unable to exercise those powers, but also that he's unable to pass them on. So the standard lineage of inheritance has been broken by this usurping of political power. So thirsty for power, then, Antonio has entered into an alliance with the King of Naples, we're hearing here, to whom he pays allegiance, and has bound his rule, the coronet, to the larger kingdom, the crown. So a previously proud and superior Milan now bows to Naples. That was the way that Antonio was able to seize political power. So that's one dispossession that's going on within the play. The other one, the more famous one in a sense, is the dispossession of Caliban of the island. Caliban, we are told, is the son of the foul witch Sycorax, and Prospero recounts to the spirit Ariel how the blue-eyed hag, this is the witch, was hither brought with child, and here was left by the sailors, so that Caliban's mother was abandoned on this island. Caliban was then born on that island. So Prospero is acknowledging that Caliban was born on the island, and so might have a legitimate claim to its possession, and this was before he, Prospero, had arrived. But he then does everything he can to diminish that birthright. After Sycorax dies, Prospero contends, then was this island, save for the son that she did litter here, a freckled whelp, hag-born, not honoured with a human shape. Now Ariel, the spirit, replies in a much more humanising way, yes, Caliban, her son. But Prospero seeks to deny that humanity. He uses the word son, but he also uses the verb litter, which is obviously much more commonly used of animals. And freckled whelp suggests a canine pup, a dog, a small dog. Hag-born again demeans the mother. And he even denies that Caliban shares the shape of humans. And shortly afterwards, Prospero calls Caliban, thou poisonous slave, got by the devil himself upon thy wicked dam, dam being the mother. So this attempt through a sort of a racializing discourse to dispossess the right of Caliban to the island, which is very common in early 17th century narratives of colonization more generally. So Caliban's then thus the dispossessed and directly claims this of Prospero. This island's mine, he says, by Sycorax, my mother, which thou takest from me. And he notes that when Prospero first arrived on the island, he treated him with kindness, and that he responded by love and showing him all of the qualities of the isle, the fresh springs, brine pits, barren places, and fertile. But now, Caliban alone, of all of the subjects that Prospero has, which he says, was first mine as king, and here you stymie in this hard rock, whilst thou do keep from me the rest of the island. So initially he's claiming he was his own master, he was the king of the island, he was the ruler. But now he's imprisoned within a specific site in that island as a slave, only subject to a new master, this is Prospero. And he's reduced to an animal, so this reference to the notion of a sty, again implying a bestial dwelling, a place where animals would live. But Prospero's response to this is interesting because he says the only reason that Caliban has been imprisoned is because of what Caliban has done, or rather what he seeks to do, which is an attempted rape of Prospero's daughter Miranda. Caliban dreams, it seems, of colonising the island himself, wishing that he had been able to rape Miranda, and his idea is that he would people else this island with Caliban's. So Shakespeare here uses the word violate the honour of my child to hint at this attack, this rape of Prospero's daughter Miranda. But rape, of course, while today having primarily a sexual sense, also comes from the Latin word ripari, meaning to seize or to abduct or to capture. So the rape of the Sabine women, the rape of Lucretia in Shakespeare's own prose poem. So that the rape of Caliban's island through Prospero's actions is paralleled by Caliban's attempted rape of Prospero's daughter. So there's a complicated set of relations in terms of possession that are being fought out here. So that Caliban is continually talking about the dispossession that has cheated him of his island. And he then tries to use the butler Stefano and the jester Trinculo to try to allow him to get that island back from Prospero. He uses them to try to reclaim what he has been dispossessed from. Now, there's a whole set of racial complications about Caliban, about whether he is an African. The play, given the geographical locations that are mentioned in the text, the play seems to have been set somewhere in the Mediterranean, or whether he is Native American, whether this is buying into a constructed sense of Native America, early 17th century, that would also make sense. But I think it is more plausible to follow the broadly African line, in that if you plot the geographical points that are mentioned, that the island seems to be somewhere between Naples and Tunis, so somewhere between the foot of Italy and the African coast. It's clearly, though, a colonial set of encounters that are going on here. Now, Antonio, this is the third figure here that's important. Antonio has seized the territory of Milan from Prospero, but then becomes lost at sea. This is the tempest of the title. And his counsellor, Gonzalo, speaks about this in terms of this worry they are. They're at sea, they're lost, they can't find land. Now would I give 1,000 furlongs of sea, says Gonzalo, for an acre of barren ground, long heath, brown firs, anything. The wills above be done, but I would fain die a dry death. That this idea that they would exchange all of the sea that they've got around them, the maritime territory in a sense, for any kind of possession of land territory, even the unfertile kind of land that is being suggested there by the heath or the firs. So you have these three characters who have this relation to possession and dispossession of land. You have Prospero, who's been dispossessed but is claiming the new island as his territory. You have Caliban, who's been dispossessed and enslaved, but dreams of a biological colonisation of that island to reclaim it for himself and for his ancestors. And you have the one who is dispossessed, but then in the storm, the tempest, loses everything, Antonio. So all three of them have these colonising tendencies. All of them have these, I think, interesting relations to the question of territory. Now, I'm not going to say a great deal about this, but there's a peculiar sort of interlude, a kind of play within the play that happens here, which is a mask that's put on by Prospero. And that these divinities appear in this, and they talk about a whole range of questions. But what I'm interested in this is around the kind of the agricultural sense that's going on here, about the idea of it's not simply the land itself, but it's what you do to the land that produces value, that produces wealth, that allows you to lay claim to it. So in this long passage we have here a whole listing of various types of crops. We have references to pasture land for animals. We have references to the flowers that are blooming in particular places, to vineyards, to a coastline, to the air above, to the water outside. All sorts of elements within the idea of property and land, which is important in terms of the colonising mentality that's at the time that Shakespeare is writing around these questions. The argument was frequently made that the Native Americans didn't really own the lands that they were in because they were not, the argument went, they were not actually adding value to it through the transformative potential of their labour, that they were living on the land rather than owning the land, and that these kinds of arguments, which you can find in a variety of places, John Locke being one of the classical places for this, and the arguments taken forward from Locke, these kinds of arguments about what gives you possession in a land are important and form a resonance around these ideas. And that the response to this around these ideas again talks about this idea of kind of fecundity or of the productivity through labour that can transform a land through these ideas. And that the Roman goddess Ceres, who's being referred to in these ideas, is about that idea of cultivating the earth. It's the idea of agriculture, cultivating the fields, the agris, of doing work on, of labouring on, of producing, of transforming through practices. And the ideas you find still in modern colonial projects, so the idea of making the desert bloom, that Israel talks about is one of those ideas of transforming it and dispossessing the Bedouin people from the Negev Desert, for example. And you even find that in The Tempest, where they talk about Adrian, the Lord, says this place seems to be desert or desert, that it is most obviously meaning deserted, that there are no people there, but that it has been not transformed through those practices, it has not been worked on and acted on in those ways. And later, Gonzalo, the political advisor, wishes that he has plantation of this isle, and that, again, clear colonial connotations, the plantations first in Ireland, but then in the New World. But what he talks about is what he will do to this place, and this isn't so much about the kind of the agricultural transformation of the physical geography of it, but it's about the kind of political community that he will build in this location. So he says, "In the Commonwealth I would by contraries execute all things, for no kind of traffic would I admit, no name of magistrate, letters should not be known, riches, poverty, and use of service, none, contract, succession, born, bound of land, tilth, vineyard, none, no use of metal, corn or wine or oil, no occupation, all men idle, all, and women too, but innocent and pure, no sovereignty." And he continually gets interrupted as he's giving this kind of outline of the political programme that he wants to put forth in this place. But he continues eventually to suggest all things in common should produce without sweat or endeavour, treason, felony, sword, pike, knife, gun, or need of any engine, would I not have, but nature should bring forth of its own kind, all foison, all abundance, to feed my innocent people, I would with such perfection govern, sir. But that kind of idealistic, kind of utopian construction of the Commonwealth that he's proposing is criticised by characters in the play who are continually interrupting him, of saying this is unrealistic, this is silly, this isn't actually going to work, but also by a lot of the modern criticism of the play that suggests this is kind of hyperbole, that this isn't actually practical or possible, that it's this utopian construction. But it's a Commonwealth or a body politic that he's proposing without a market or a commerce, without traffic, he says, no bureaucracy or written records, no discrepancy of wealth or indentured servitude, no inheritance, no born, this is a boundary or a limit, no bound of land, again, a critique of enclosure, which is obviously important at the time Shakespeare's writing, no agricultural working of the soil, no occupation, an occupation here not simply meaning a profession or a job that you might have, your employment, but also meaning a marital cohabitation, meaning the question of seized presence of something, of the land being dispossessed or taken away from those who held it before. No sovereignty, but instead shared property and absence of ills, producing abundance and happiness. But if that's a Commonwealth without internal divisions, the kind of argument that he's making here of breaking down of enclosure, of breaking down of barriers between people, it's still very hard to imagine it without some kind of boundaries on the outside, to imagine it outside of territorial orderings more generally. Now, the two other plays that I want to talk about more briefly, I'm just going to say a little bit about another play first, which is Othello, because Othello, it seems to me, is an interesting play for colonial reasons as well. It's largely set in Cyprus, and Cyprus is a possession of Venice, but is one that is being contested by the Ottoman Turks. So there's this threat to Venice's colonising in the Eastern Mediterranean from the Ottomans. And Othello has made his reputation in what are called the Cyprus Wars, and it's the threat again to Cyprus that sends him back out there with Desdemona and with Iago, and where most of the narrative of the play takes place. That the Turks are challenging that supremacy that the Venetians have in the Eastern Mediterranean. And the Duke charges him, "Valiant Othello, we must straight employ you against the general enemy Ottoman." So there's this kind of threat of Islam encroaching on parts of European possession that's being played out in there. But as the editor of the Arden Third Series notes, Shakespeare doesn't really do very much with this in the play. It's there as a kind of a threat or as a worry that Othello has to deal with, but it's not there as something that's worked through in detail. There's a lot, he says, the editor's suggesting here, there's a lot of geographical references, but Shakespeare doesn't really work them through in much detail. He doesn't actually think these through in terms of specific voyages or travels or so, and these are more sort of markers of the geography of the time. And the suggestion that's being made here is that Shakespeare doesn't do very much more than Cinthio, the Italian writer who wrote Un Capitano Murano, the Moorish captain, which was the source of Shakespeare's play Othello. So Shakespeare doesn't really work through the geographical elements within that. Pericles, though, I think is a play that actually does a lot more with these kinds of arguments, and also an Eastern Mediterranean setting to that play. And it's a play that is generally acknowledged now to have not been solely written by Shakespeare, but certainly that he wrote large elements within the play, that George Wilkins is likely as the other author of the play. And it was a play that wasn't included in the first folio, the first collected edition of Shakespeare's writings, but has generally been accepted into the canon since that time. Now, in the play, Pericles is continually on the move. He's shipwrecked a couple of times, he's always taking into the boats again, he's always moving between different locations, and finally, at the end of the play, returns home to replace his father as the ruler of Tyre. Tyre is now in modern-day Lebanon. And the location of the play continually changes between islands and coastlines, but all in the Eastern Mediterranean. Syria's mentioned, there are places in Greece and in North Africa. And as a result of these changing locations, it's more kind of episodic than most of Shakespeare's plays. It doesn't really have a clear story, and this may also be part to do with the two authors that are involved in the writing of this. But it does seem to me that there's something quite interesting going on. A number of other people have suggested about this could also be seen as a play that has that kind of colonial sense going on within its pages. And so Susan Gossett, in the introduction to the Arden third series of the play, talking about these different locations, the movement between them, of being important in terms not simply of the time that the play was set in the period after the fall of Alexander the Great's empire, but in the period that Shakespeare and Wilkins are writing, at a period when these transformations, again through the Ottoman Turks, are happening within this area of the world that they would know about. So Shakespeare and Wilkins, the suggestion goes, are actually linking up the historical setting and the time that the play is being written to think about these ideas. And this was a time when new atlases were starting to emerge of more maps historically. This is a map from Ortelius's Theatrum Orbis Terrarum from 1570. But the point of that atlas that's interesting for this is it's not simply that it provides more accurate maps of the world at the time the atlas was produced, the New World, the discoveries in the New World, filling in the detail around the continents that are being discovered. But this is one of the maps in there, and it's a historical map. It's the map of the Roman Empire, the classical Roman Empire. And so this is one that shows nearly all of the locations that Shakespeare talks about in the play Pericles. And so it's interesting in terms of what that play creates in terms of a sort of a geographical imagination that Shakespeare and his collaborator are able to exploit and think through in the play. So if I can just focus in particularly on the area of the Eastern Mediterranean and just point out some of those locations. So that the area of the Eastern Mediterranean there, the city of Tyre is there on the Lebanon coast. Antioch, I mean, there's a few potential places that could be the Antioch of the story, but it seems most likely that it's the area there on the modern border between Turkey and Syria. To move around to Tarsus, which is a place where Pericles appears. He actually helps to stave off a famine in Tarsus, and then later in the play returns to kind of call in the debt of what he's done. Ephesus, which is more easily located. The island of Lesbos, with the capital of Mytilene, which is one of the places where Prospero's daughter Marina is sold into prostitution, and then is eventually rescued from that area. And there's one place in the play that doesn't appear on this map, but in the accompanying text in Ortelius, it seems clear that this idea of Cyrene down there in the North African coast is the possible site of the city of Pentapolis that's mentioned in the play. Pentapolis really means pentapolis. It means five cities or five cities together in a single place. And there were several places in antiquity that were described as Pentapolis. But the suggestion is that this is the North African example of that. But what that actually gives then is around the coastline of the Eastern Mediterranean, all of these different locations that are part of that play, and between three continents, between Europe, Asia and Africa. So that kind of the known world at the time the play is set, certainly, of being the three elements within the world. And this is interesting again in terms of settlement, because Pericles is going to these different places either to settle, to win contest that he gets involved in to try and rescue his daughter, or he's shipwrecked and so on. And the suggestion has been made by various people that there's a kind of colonising mentality to the way that Pericles conducts himself through this play. In the chorus is a device that's used to precede most of the episodes of the play, where a character based on Gower comes in and speaks to sort of fill in the background. Because it's so episodic and because there's a long time period between different parts of the play, the chorus helps the person watching this in the theatre to actually understand what's actually taking place at the time. And it's this continual sense of they're in the boats again, they're sailing off, they're going to appear in a place completely different from the one where the last scene or act was set, and to give that kind of narrative. And he's talking about the way that the audience needs to forget or forgive the fact that they're always doing this in the same language, even though they're moving between these very different locations. There's a whole range of other things going on in the play that are interesting around the kind of geographies of the time. So the pirates that are important in the play in terms of the renewed threat of piracy in the Eastern Mediterranean at the time of the Jacobean period in England. So there's a whole set of questions there around the geographies and the colonising. And various other people have suggested this. So Steve Mentz's really excellent book, At the Bottom of Shakespeare's Ocean, talking about Pericles as a coloniser and talking about the different things that he does as relating to that colonising mentality of the time. The play was likely written in 1607, which was the time that the first English permanent settlement in North America was established in Jamestown. So there's a kind of Shakespeare's would have been likely reading news reports about these different things that were happening, and this would have made sense in terms of the interests of his audience at the time that he's writing. And others have talked about the kind of different geographies that flip through the play, of these kind of presentation of different settings in these different diverse and kind of ethnically variable places, and the kind of exoticism and so on of the travel literature of the time is being played out on the stage for the audience. And the expansion that Mentz is highlighting here is one that, even though it's onto land, onto islands, onto coastlines and so on, it's made possible by the sea. It's a colonising that's taking place by sea, rather than the kind of contiguous colonisation of, say, a Russia or a China that expands to contiguous lands to their own central locations. This, like the British Empire, is a kind of saltwater colonisation. It's done by sea, it's done at a distance. In the same way, actually, that the Roman Empire should be understood as expanding by sea as well. Yes, of course, it expands by land through the Italian peninsula into southern France, Gaul, and then through Gaul and up towards Britain. But it also colonises all of the land around the Mediterranean, which makes sense of the way that the Romans thought of the Mediterranean as Mare Nostrum or Mare Internum, the internal sea or our sea, or even kind of the idea of a kind of Roman lake, of this sense of the colonisation. Let me go back to the map, colonisation that expands from Rome and then round the whole coastline of the Mediterranean and then to varying degrees of distance from that coastline. So it's a colonisation that's made possible by the sea. The final thing, just for a few minutes, I'm going to say something about Antony and Cleopatra, which is Shakespeare's other kind of Eastern Mediterranean play. And I think it's certainly the most colonial of all of Shakespeare's Roman plays, although I think there's some very interesting geographical and territorial issues in Coriolanus, which I've written about in another piece of this project. Let me just say a few things about Antony and Cleopatra and then some general comments to conclude. Unlike most of Shakespeare's love stories, or at least the early ones like Romeo and Juliet, this love story, the story of Antony and Cleopatra, is played out not just with a geopolitical backdrop, but with the geopolitics and the interpersonal relations completely intertwined all the way through that. And it's not simply Marcus Antonius or Mark Antony, the Roman general who's gone to Egypt and falls in love with Cleopatra. It's also in terms of the relations that Mark Antony has to Octavius. Octavius was the nephew of Julius Caesar, was adopted as his son in Caesar's will, and became in time the Emperor Augustus. Octavius and Mark Antony are joined together because Octavius's sister, Octavia, is married to Mark Antony, and that marriage is done as a strategic alliance. Octavius here is saying that there's no way that we will remain in friendship unless we can find some kind of way that will bind us together, that we will have some kind of family link around that. So the interpersonal and the geopolitical closely intertwined through a whole range of questions in that play. The geopolitical elements are often cut in stage versions. There's kind of good reason for this. I mean, it's very difficult to stage a maritime battle on a stage and make that work. And so these are often cut, not just because they're difficult to stage, but also because of length. It's a long play, it's one of Shakespeare's longer plays, and to make it cut down to a more manageable running time. But like that happened, the same sort of thing happens with Hamlet. There's a whole geopolitical story, I think, that's very important to Hamlet that often gets cut for stage and film adaptations because of length and because of viability and so on. But in this play, the geopolitical is really, I think, important to the overall narrative. And imagery of the world is very important to the play. It's a continual thing that gets talked about there, that the world, the Roman world, the known world that's being dominated by these key figures, keeps being talked about throughout the play in relation to individuals, in relation to their stake in those places. So the organisation is the triumvirate, the three men of Octavius Caesar, of Mark Antony and of Lepidus, the three commanders after Julius Caesar's death and after that civil war of hunting down the people that have killed Caesar. Those three people have each got sort of land or territorial command of different parts of the Roman Empire. And Antony is then described as the triple pillar of the world, i.e. one of the three pillars that holds up the world. That he is, unfortunately though, the argument goes, he's been transformed into a strumpet's fool, that the Cleopatra relation has been his undoing as a military and as a political commander of Rome. The three world sharers are mentioned, and Cleopatra describes Antony as this demi-Atlas, again, one of two figures, she seems to forget Lepidus at this point, one of two figures that are holding the world on their shoulders, that are controlling and commanding the world. And there's a whole set of transformations that take part in the play. Lepidus allies himself with Sextus Pompeius, the son of Pompey the Great. Lepidus then has his army and his forces taken away from him, so then there are just those two figures butting against each other. And then the suggestion is, then world, thou hast a pair of chaps. Chaps here is chops or jaws, not men. And throw between them all the food thou hast, they'll grind the one the other. These two individuals, Mark Antony and Octavius Caesar, are now going to fight out the future development of the world. Octavius defeats Antony, and Cleopatra bemoans that loss, and she talks about him in this sort of very evocative language of this kind of world historical figure that has been bestriding the world, his legs bestride the ocean. She talks about the little O of the earth, the globe of the earth, the orb of the earth, and the kind of the figure that he was marching through this world, history sort of trailing behind him through the actions that he was taking part in. And talking about crowns and coronets, kings or dukes and so on, sort of hanging on to the kind of hem of his cloak and sort of being carried forward through history by the transformations he was making. Realms and islands were as plates, coins, dropped from his pocket. So there's the whole geographical imaginary linked to the characterisation of this figure that Cleopatra is obviously in love with and is bemoaning the loss of them. And this O, the circular, and the idea of a three-part earth is interesting, because it relates to the way that the cartography of the time would have represented the known world. You have the orb of the world, but on that orb of the world you have the world island, the parts of the world that are known at this time, and the division between those. So that when Octavius defeats Antony at the Battle of Actium, then he talks about the way that the time of universal peace is near. Prove this a prosperous day, the three-nooked world shall bear the olive freely, it shall experience peace, because he has defeated all of his enemies. But what is this three-nooked world? And that's really the last kind of geographical reference that I want to mention here. And it's this idea of the way that the maps were constructed at the time, certainly of the late Roman Empire. This is from Isidore of Seville's Etymologies. And it's a map of the world that has become known as a T. The T going across here in O. So these are known as T-O maps or T-in-O maps. What you have here is the Danube River and the Nile River and the Mediterranean. If you rotate this 90 degrees clockwise, you'll orient it to the way that we think about it today. But the way that they oriented it was orient to the east, so the east was at the top of the map. So this map is kind of needs to be rotated clockwise 90 degrees to make sense today. But you have here Europe, Africa, and Asia, the three parts of the three nooked world of this construction. Surrounding them is the Mare Oceanum, the O of the map. It's the world island with the ocean surrounding it. And the people that are named in each of those locations, in Asia, Europa, and in Africa, are the three sons of Noah, Shem, Cham, and Japheth. And that the key at the bottom, the text on the bottom right of that says, "Behold how the sons of Noah divided the world after the flood." There's the world island surrounded by water, divided into the three continents that at the time were the known continents. So it's this link between the geographies and the kind of language of world and world division and the characters that's important in terms of thinking about those kinds of questions. Now the plays I've discussed in brief here are for actually from a relatively few years of Shakespeare's career. The date's disputed, of course. The dating of Shakespeare's plays is extremely complicated, but the general consensus seems to be Othello is the earliest of these, from sort of 1603, 1604. Antony and Cleopatra from 1606. Pericles from 1607. The Tempest from 1610 to 11. And that relatively close proximity might be part a product of the kinds of things that Shakespeare is reading and that people are being discussed in Jacobean England at the time, and the colonial practices going on at that time. There are traces of colonising practices elsewhere in Shakespeare, so for example the shipwrecks in The Merchant of Venice that bankrupt Antonio seem to have been kind of trade between the New World and the Old. But in these use of these different plays, in Shakespeare's kind of past historical setting of Antony and Cleopatra, the past semi-mythical in Pericles, the near-contemporary in Othello, and the fantastical allegorical of The Tempest, some of these issues around colonial territories, I think, are being opened up in some interesting ways. And that's one element of it. This is what I'm trying to do, is to use these different plays in different registers to open up different aspects of the question of territory, to talk about division and the politics of land, of contestation, of the corporeal body of the state, talk about vulnerability in the international, what might lie outside of territory as well. And what I mean by outside territory is not outside of one territory, but in another territory, the standard way we think about things today. You cross one border and you've ended up in the southern territory of another place. But what might be outside of territorial orderings entirely? And I think that at the time Shakespeare's writing, those places exist, but they're fast disappearing, partly through these colonising projects. But I think in As You Like It, a play that's often been read as a kind of critique of the enclosure movement, or in Titus Andronicus, an early play where there's a contrast between Rome and the forest outside of Rome, where the Germanic tribes, the Goths, are living. Maybe that is a hint of how people would have understood what is outside of territory, outside of territorial orderings. And that time period, when Shakespeare's writing, is one of the reasons I'm interested in Shakespeare. I think he's at that moment when the transformations are happening and we can think about these kind of questions in interesting ways, to think about territory conceptually, historically, and politically. And Shakespeare is, I think, very productive in opening up some of those questions.
Thank you. Thanks, Stuart.